Hey, this is Duray, and welcome to Pod Save the People. On this episode, we have Ivetayo Beverly Johnson, the executive director of the United Health Organization and Project Healthy Living, and we have the author, Mary Otto. Both of them are here to talk to us about teeth. And we have the news with me, Brittany, Clint, and Sam, as usual. We put Clint's news at the beginning of the normal news segment because he wasn't with us in recording this time. So you'll hear him give his news, and then you'll hear the news the way you normally hear it. Love Clint. Happy we got his news this week. And before we jump into this episode, my word for this week is about following your hunch. So I think about some of the big projects that we did. They started with a question. We had a thought, an idea, and we followed it to see if we were right. So when we did the big police union contract project, we didn't know that the police union contracts actually had these clauses in it, but we had a guess and we had a question that it might. And we followed the hunch. We did the research, and then we found things that were even more wild than we thought might be there. So remember to follow your hunch. And then the last thing is that the book comes out on September 4th. And you can get it at Duray.com, D-R-A-Y.com. You can pre-order it now. And remember that a portion of the pre-sales, up to $20,000, actually goes to help the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And they are fighting for our rights right now. They're doing a lot of work around the Supreme Court nomination. So pre-order it now. Support me. Support the work. Appreciate it.
What's going on, y'all? I've been thinking about how people sometimes in the conversation around immigration and immigration reform, people attempt to create this sort of moral distinction between their own ancestors who immigrated to this country in comparison to many of the folks arriving at the southern border today by saying some iteration of, well, my early ancestors came here legally, which the very statement implies that others, you know, largely Black and brown folks coming in now, should do the same. And the thing about this is that it largely ignores how immigration laws are wholly different now than they were for the vast majority of American history. And essentially between the 17th century and the early 20th century, immigrants basically poured into the U.S. by the thousands and thousands and thousands because there essentially were no immigration laws to break in the first place. So for example, only 1% of people who showed up at Ellis Island were turned away. For the most part, you just got on a boat, showed up, and you started your new life. And it wasn't until the passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, which pretty much just as it sounds, was designed to exclude people of Chinese descent from entering the United States, that we had any federal restriction on who could enter the country at all of any kind. And as we move into the 20th century, even after Congress implemented immigration quotas in an attempt to keep out Southern and Eastern Europeans who, at this point in history, experienced profound racial discrimination and, as we've discussed before, were not necessarily seen as white in the way that they ultimately assimilated to be, they were kept out via the 1921 Emergency Quota Act and the 1924 National Origins Act. But despite those restrictions, people from these countries still continued to sneak into the U.S. by the thousands upon thousands upon thousands. And while it's clear that racism has always been the sort of central dynamic that has shaped trends in U.S. immigration, I also think people underappreciate how an Irish farmer facing famine in the 19th century and a mother in Central America fleeing violence in the 21st century, both basically just want safety and security for their family. So people saying, well, my Irish great-grandfather would have come here legally if those had been the laws in place. You don't know that. None of us do. And it's quite possible that he would have felt a sense of desperation that made him and his family circumnavigate the system. Because when you want safety for your family, you'll often do things that exist beyond the sort of limited frameworks of legality and non-legality. So just something important to keep in mind as we continue to have this conversation around immigration and what it should look like.
Hey, y'all, it's the news. This is Brittany Packnett at Miss Packetti on all social media.
And this is Sam Sinyangwe at Sam Sui on Twitter and Instagram.
And this is Duray at Duray on Twitter.
So, y'all, I saw Black Klansman this weekend.
Oh, was snap. It as good as people said it was?
It's probably better than people said it was, to be honest.
I've heard mixed reviews, Britt.
I can only give you my review. Here's what my review is. My review is that Spike is back in full effect, being Spike at his best. I feel like I was already excited about the movie, but it gave me so much more than I was expecting. And the thing about a Spike Lee joint is that there are themes that they're going to make very, very obvious to you. And then there are themes that you're going to continue to turn over in your head for days and weeks and months after. And I'm at the point where I'm really thinking about some of the more subtle themes about patriarchy and white women in particular, around the inside-outside strategy. There are just so many complex things that are being pulled and teased apart. And you're not necessarily being given an answer, but you are being provoked to consider these things. And then there are the really obvious themes that, like, that are clear, right? White supremacy is bad.
One of the things that I heard, though, Britt, is that people said that there was like a false equivalency between the KKK and the Panthers. Again, I haven't seen it, but since we're talking about it, I thought I'd ask you because you saw it.
Yeah, so I remember having this moment, actually, and I think I know which scenes they're talking about just because of the way they're juxtaposed in the movie. I took it very differently, though. This is what art does, right? It causes you to have conversations and interpret things in many different ways. I actually took it to be differentiating between so-called white power and black power. In examining what they're rooted in, right? So the scenes are literally like cutting in and out from each other, but without giving a spoiler, I think that, and what struck me the most was actually what black power is rooted in and the stories that were told around that and why it was necessary versus why people were calling out white power and the things that inspired that. So I feel like I get how people could walk away with that. I would urge people to reconsider the actual dialogue in that space. And I'm trying really hard not to give spoilers, but you have to go see it.
Got it.
I'm excited to see it. And it's a true story, right?
Yeah, it's based on a true story. Ron Stallworth is real. He wrote a book on it, so it's based on his book. And, you know, there's like a really good, there's some good follow-up articles about what was creative license and what was real. But a lot of it was very real and surprising. David Duke's toupee is also apparently one of the things that's very accurate in the film. So, it is based on a true story. I find it to be really provocative, especially given that the very tiny Unite the Right rally was happening yesterday. I'm still a little worried being a part-time DC resident that like the march itself was always going to be small and is perhaps a distraction from something else going on. And so I hope that that's not true. But like in the shadow of the anniversary of Charlottesville, the murder of Heather Heyer, and that march, I like watched it that night. And it was chilling, to be totally frank. And this is not an ad. I just really like the movie.
Let's also talk about the Unite the Right rally just because it happened. Brittany already gave some feedback on it. Tim, do you have any?
I mean, I thought it was obscene, the level of police protection that the white supremacists received. You know, it was a situation where they got a police escort. There were more police protecting them than there were white supremacists. And it's a reminder that the police response to white supremacists is sort of handling them with kid gloves and protection, where black protesters are handled with violence, right? And that juxtaposition, I think, speaks volumes about the role of police and the way that they see their role and who they see themselves as responsible to defend in society.
I was actually, you know, NPR interviewed one of the leaders of the rally, and what was both shocking about the interview and disappointing was at the end, the guy made a case for scientific racism. Like, he literally is like, you know, we know that people's bodies are different. And because we know there's differences in people's bodies, there must be differences in people's minds. Like, that's how he sort of sets it up. And then he says, well, the differences in the IQ starts off with Jews. Jews have the highest IQ. And then he goes down and it's like white people, Latinos, and black people. That's sort of like the last three, right? And the host doesn't challenge him as much as the host sort of like asks another question. You're like, okay.
Wait, what white supremacist taxonomy is this? So now Jews are at the top of the hierarchy in the Nazi movement? Like, I don't understand how that, like, when did that happen?
So Sam, here's the thing, is that what he says though, is he says, well, I'm not a white supremacist, because if I was a white supremacist, I would say that white people have the highest IQ, but the data doesn't say that. The data says that Jews have the highest IQ. You know, like, this is like the argument he's espousing, right? And the host just like lets it go unchallenged, which is like, it was wild to read in the transcript. It was wild to hear. And, you know, when we see the media do this, like, well, this is an argument and we have to cover all the arguments. What I keep saying to myself is like, you know who wasn't on NPR? those people who shot up that newspaper, they weren't on NPR. Like, the people who think that the media should be crucified and killed, they're not on NPR. They're not on anybody's morning show. They're not on the news. Why? Because all the people in the media realize that that language actually has deadly consequences. Like, they get it. But when we talk about white supremacy and race, people still espouse this, like, both sides thing. And it's just not, it not only is it not true, but it actually is really dangerous for people.
And it's a reminder that, like, these reporters, many of them are not equipped to even respond, right? Like, they probably even believe this stuff. Or if they don't believe it, they don't know how to effectively challenge it. And I think that's a huge problem for the media, not really being qualified to interview folks in the first place if they don't know how to accurately figure out sort of how to debunk these sort of pseudoscientific claims that are so often used to justify white supremacy.
Could not agree more. I was very disappointed in that interview, in the construction of that segment, and putting someone who, you know, supposedly is from the Black Lives Matter end of things in some kind of direct opposition or juxtaposition, as if they're two sides of the same coin. And we keep having this conversation, and it's and we keep pushing the media on this, and it some days it just feels like we're actually not making any traction on it. I was quite disappointed in that one. Shall we get to the news?
Sure. So let's talk about Cincinnati, where last week police tased an 11-year-old girl in the back as she walked away for allegedly shoplifting food from a convenience store. And then they charged her with obstructing official business and theft. So since this case has sort of made national news, it has prompted a response from the city. Number one, they've responded by dropping the charges. The prosecutor dropped the charges against the girl, which is good. But it's also brought to light the fact that the police use of force policy in Cincinnati allows the police to taser people over the age of 7, only 7 years old. And, you know, this is another example of how police policies often enable them to use violence against and harm civilians in situations that are so obviously unnecessary. You know, people who are, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old, or 11 years old in this case, can be tased in Cincinnati. And, you know, it's important to note that this is not the case everywhere. So in some police departments, there are more restrictions on how police can use tasers, restricting them from using tasers against any children, for example, as is the case in Chicago, in all cases where the person is not actively attacking the police, right? And so, you know, I bring this to the table just to once again emphasize the fact that policy matters, and that oftentimes these policies that are in place in plain sight in police departments allow them to continually use violence in a way that is authorized by their department, and therefore does not result in any type of accountability.
And, you know, so often we have the conversation around police violence only in the context of death. And obviously, that is the most extreme outcome to police violence. But police violence is exacted upon people, and obviously disproportionately upon marginalized people, people of color, Black people, and Indigenous people, every single day in many, many different ways. And this is an example of that. Because when we're talking about police violence, we're not just talking about the roots of police forces in this country and the ways in which they were created to control Black bodies and other bodies instead of actually serve and protect. We're not just talking about bad apples, right? We're talking about an entirely problematic system. But we're also talking about disproportionate responses. I remember I was a kid. I don't remember how old I was, but back when Toys R Us was still a thing, I remember stealing a key for a caboodle. A caboodle was like a little makeup and jewelry chest in fun colors that they marketed to little girls. I had one, but I lost the key. And so there was like a key taped to the caboodle, and I stole it, right? Because I was a kid. Kids test boundaries. Like, kids do this all the time, and there doesn't end up being a problem. I wasn't caught in the store, but my mother caught me when we got home. She made me return it, and she told me never to do that again because she was very clear that I did not have the same space and room to be a child that white children do. This is happening to children of color all the time because the disproportionate response that people of color receive, even children of color receive, can be deeply harmful. It can have physical effects like being tased. It can end up in death. So my mom wanted me to be very clear. I'm not angry with you. You should never steal things that are not yours. And this is a lesson that you need to learn. But you also need to learn the lesson that what will be treated like a small infraction for a white child can be a major infraction for you. And it's important to recognize that these disproportionate responses are happening not just in cases of bad judgment by a single police officer, but to your point, Sam, in the cases of policy that is written down, mandated, and shared across departments, as is the case here in Cincinnati.
Yeah, the only thing I'll say is that I'm always reminded about the way the rules function on the hidden level and people don't realize. So this happens and people are outraged. They're like, oh my God, how could you tase a kid? And what is their response? Their response is like, we were following the rules, right? The rules say that like gotta be over 7 and she was over 7. And like the conversation normally stops there and people hear it and they're like, well, that was not a violation of policy. And you're like, that's right. And that is an indictment of the system, an indictment of the policy. And what we'd say is that there are things like this all across the country, that these things are hidden. People are like, oh my God, that's wrong. So even in Baltimore, where everybody just saw the video of the officer like beat up the man and there's no justification at any point that he should have touched him at all, let alone beat him up the way we saw happen on the video, is that that officer just resigned. He's going to be able to do whatever he wants in another district. It doesn't look like he's going to get charged right now, so we'll see. But what's interesting is that the state law literally says that an officer in probation, which was that officer, that the officer can be fired for a host of things during probation, except for an instance of brutality. Like, that's such a wild thing to carve out. But everybody saying that the police officer should be fired, like me, the response from the system is like, well, we can't fire him because the law says that he can't actually get fired on probation just for brutality. And it's like, you know, we have so much more work to do to help people realize the way that the system is set up that protects the worst things that happen in society, especially from people who are supposed to be public servants.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People is coming.
So speaking of police and this entire system, we had a really big victory last week in St. Louis. We talked about the work that was done both locally and nationally to oust 27-year county prosecutor incumbent Bob McCullough in my hometown of St. Louis County, where I still split my time. We were able to replace Bob McCullough with a young African-American new county prosecutor, Wesley Bell. Now, this was a primary, but it is a highly Democratic county, and so it is a foregone conclusion that Wesley Bell will be the next county prosecutor. Huge victory. I mean, it was led by local activists, the Bye Bob campaign, with folks like our friend Kayla at the forefront, were really critical in helping people reimagine a new future for St. Louis County. And in doing so, took down an incumbent that people thought was impossible to defeat. There had been lawsuits brought to say that Bob McCullough had not done his job effectively and that he had been patently racist for all of that 27 years. That lawsuit was dismissed. There were also challenges to Bob McCullough's ethical fitness, and those challenges were roundly denied. And yet the people took the power in their hands and made sure that Wesley Bell would replace Bob McCullough on the ticket as a Democratic nominee. Here's what's really important about Bob McCullough, though. If you don't know, Bob McCullough is the primary reason why Darren Wilson, the officer who killed Michael Brown, never saw the inside of a jail cell and was never even indicted for that crime. A lot of people, from Harvard law professors to national and local legal analysts, were highly critical of Bob McCullough's engagement with the grand jury around the Darren Wilson case. We've heard the phrase before that a prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich if they want to, and yet Darren Wilson is still a free man, and there are plenty of peaceful protesters who have spent more time in jail than Darren Wilson ever did. Justin Hansford, one of those protesters and a friend of ours, who's also the head of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center at Georgetown, wrote an opinion piece in the Washington Post of which I am in full support, basically saying that that should not continue to be the case and that Wesley Bell, once he is inaugurated, should reopen the case of Michael Brown's killing and the potential indictment of Darren Wilson. He calls the fact that that indictment has not happened a gaping wound in the nation's psyche. And I think that's critically important when we recognize Ferguson as a catalyst for movements all across the world, as a catalyst that re-engaged and reignited a racial justice movement in this country. The fact that that case still remains in the state in which it is, the fact that there was such an injustice done in that particular case, is something that is still a deep wound for a lot of people. And I think could both symbolically and literally move us forward should that case be reopened and prosecuted in the way that it should have been in the first place. And so I'm proud of the people for taking our future in our hands, but we should certainly have a full circle moment and engage in the kind of accountability that we need to see across the entire country.
You know, it's been so inspiring to see, you know, local activists and organizers in St. Louis, and also in, you know, we saw in Chicago and in Cleveland and in so many other places successfully organizing to replace folks who have been in positions of power for so long and have used that power, like Bob McCullough, have used that power as a prosecutor to continually contribute towards a system that has allowed police violence and mass incarceration to impact particularly communities of color, you know, for decades. And so, you know, just to provide some data for this, St. Louis County has one of the highest rates of jail deaths in the country, according to an investigation from the Huffington Post. You know, St. Louis City, according to our data from Mapping Police Violence, has the highest rate of killings by police in the nation. And the St. Louis area, St. Louis County writ large, also has an elevated rate of police violence. And so, you know, these changes are happening in a context of you know, disproportionate and extremely high levels of, you know, racialized police violence and mass incarceration, and seeing folks who are being elected that are committed to actually making progress towards dismantling those systems and structures that and providing accountability, you know, in the case of Mike Brown and also in the case of so many others that have been victimized by this system is really inspiring. And so I'm looking forward to continuing to see progress being made in St. Louis and across the country to put people in power who actually are going to keep communities safe and make the changes that need to be made in order for us to be free.
When I think about this election, you know, I was hearing one of the organizers talk on the radio just today, actually. And they were saying that all the polls said that McCullough was going to win by a landslide. Every piece of data suggested that the electorate would not change. If you remember, you know, right after Mike Brown was killed, there was not the sweeping rise in turnout in the area or the region that people had hoped or thought there would be because of the protests. I remember being in the street in St. Louis along with Brittany and everybody else on No Indictment Night. And just that energy and the tension and all that stuff didn't turn into the kind of political sort of energy or force that people thought it would be. And what the organizers said today that I'll just repeat here is that they said, you know, we ignored the polls because we knew what we knew about community. And they said that they had their own data that suggested that if they delivered a candidate and a message that worked, that they would be able to change the electorate and they'd be able to win. So despite every poll up until the very end saying that McCullough would win by a landslide, they texted, they called, they canvassed, and they did it in places that traditionally didn't have high turnout. And what we saw on election day was not only did Wesley Bell win, but he handedly won. It wasn't like 1,000 votes. You know, he won by enough that it is like a legitimate mandate. So I'm proud of that. And I think that I'm proud of that for all the protesters, and also mindful that there are a lot of lessons that we can learn about the way that we have thought about success and measuring success, especially during elections or leading up to the actual elections or during campaigns, is not always true to our lived experience. And we have to trust that. So it's interesting and beautiful to see people like Ocasio-Cortez, who people thought that like that was the longest shot in America, and she won. Wesley Bell won, and people all across the country are winning. We know that elections aren't the end-all, be-all, but they do set us up for a kind of systemic change that we need.
DeRay, I think this is such a critical point. Nelson Mandela once said, it always seems impossible till it's done. And the naysayers and the critics and the analysts who are well-intentioned will often say that they can read the tea leaves in a particular way. But that doesn't mean that we stop fighting. That doesn't mean that we stop pushing. That doesn't mean that we stop innovating. And that doesn't mean that we stop putting ourselves up to make the change. Leslie McSpadden, who is Michael Brown Jr.'s mother, has announced her run for Ferguson City Council. It's an incredibly beautiful thing to see people stepping up in so many brand new ways. But I'm hopeful to see this case reopened, and I'd love to know what you all think about it.
One of the best things about the news is that there's so much stuff happening that doesn't make the public conversation, and we get to talk about it. And today's news is exactly that for me. It is about driver's licenses, is that there's a decline in the number of people getting driver's licenses, and nobody knows why. So there's a new study that just came out by two researchers at the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute. And what they know is that the percentage of people with a driver's license decreased between 2011 and 2014 across all age groups. And they also say that for people aged 16 to 44, that percentage has been decreasing steadily since 1983. Now, here's some of the percentages about the decrease. I was shocked by this, is that in 2014, just 24.5% of 16-year-olds had a license, a 47% decrease from 1983 when 46.2% did. And for 19-year-olds, 69% had licenses, driver's licenses in 2014 compared to 87.3% in 1983. A 21% decrease. Now, they don't know why, because people actually, when they have polled people, the data doesn't suggest that like public transportation is the reason why people are getting less licenses. The data suggests that the top three reasons were they were too busy to get a license, owning a vehicle is just too expensive, or they're able to get transportation from other people. So I bring this up just because I'm fascinated by, interested in what that means for cities, definitely for low-income people and people in marginalized neighborhoods, Black and brown people. I'm also interested in what this immediately made me think of was all of the systems that we build around driver's licenses. So if you think about, in most places, automatic voter registration is automatic at the DMV. Like, that is where the automaticity comes in. You even think about, like, signing up to get like a loan or like open a bank account or all these things that, like, if you don't have a driver's license, it just is much harder to do. And I'd love to think more about like the data on people who don't have driver's licenses but have other official forms of ID and like what that will mean as time continues. Because there's so many parts of this world that exist, like your entrance into them is a driver's license. And there's some cities that are better equipped to deal with this than not. So like New York City, for instance, because a lot of people don't drive because of subways. But I would believe that there are places across the country where the decrease in driver's licenses has not been met with some innovation at the city or town level.
Yeah, so this made me immediately think of voter ID. And, you know, one thing that was interesting about that article was that older Americans are more likely to have driver's licenses, but younger Americans are far less likely. And now you're seeing more states impose these voter ID laws, strict voter ID laws. And that creates this sort of dichotomy where it becomes harder and harder for younger people to participate in elections. And, you know, assuming that they don't have other forms of ID, which, you know, I'm interested to see more data on that. But I'm assuming here that that decrease in the driver's license rates is not met with an increase in other forms of ID. But if that's the case, I mean, that makes it harder for folks to participate in elections. And it's also a reminder that, you know, as our society changes, as technology changes, you know, now people can, you know, get Uber and go where they want to go, or Lyft. And so, you know, as a car, you're no longer dependent on necessarily owning a car to get around. And how our systems and structures update to reflect that reality, that you might not actually need a driver's license to drive, to transport yourself, but you still need a driver's license for all of these other things. And what can that, you know, form of ID be that people can get and that is readily available that doesn't require it?
And, you know, Sam, I'm one of those people. I kind of split my time between D.C., New York, and St. Louis. And in St. Louis, I drive. In D.C. and New York, I don't. And I left my car in St. Louis. And to be very clear, there are lots of people, even in cities where you have to drive a lot, who are still opting out of that, especially when we look at places like Ferguson, once again, that raised revenue by abusing people often by pulling them over and raising that revenue through court fines and fees and ticket fees and all of those kinds of things. So there are people for whom driving is not only not sensible anymore, it is also not always safe. And that means that, of course, we're going to see a decrease and we're going to see some communities that are persistently challenged by the need to have this kind of identification. And so I couldn't agree with you all more. There have to be solutions to this. Just because there are solutions to get people a state ID, for example, doesn't then mean that those IDs should be required for voting. And I just want to make sure that we're really clear about that. It is still a poll tax. It is still a barrier to a right of being a citizen of a democracy. And it is not something that should exist. And voter ID laws are something that we absolutely have to be fighting all across the country. So I just want to make sure that that's clear. Just because we ensure people's access to an alternative ID doesn't mean that that ID should then have to be required to do things like vote.
Right. And there is data to suggest that, you know, even when you look at this question of who has ID writ large, whether it's a driver's license or some other form of ID, there are these huge racial disparities that folks know who are creating these voter ID laws. And the data show that 8% of whites, white Americans do not have a valid photo ID compared to 25% of Black Americans and 19%.
25%?
Yeah, 25%. So Sam, 1 in 4.
That is wild.
8% of whites do not have a valid photo ID compared to 25% of Blacks and 19% of folks in the Latinx community. So those are the disparities that are being targeted when you see these voter ID laws. And then it gets even worse when, you know, driver's licenses are no longer as prevalent.
Well, learn something new every day.
Sadly, it's unsurprising, though. Again, barriers.
Right.
And that's the news.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Don't go anywhere. There's more to come.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking 3 questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action, not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.
And now my conversation with Mary Otto and Ife Tayo Beverly Johnson. Mary and Ife, thanks so much for joining us today on Pod Save the People.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Great to be here.
So I came across you two because I am obsessed with dental care. I used to be the chief of human capital in the school system in Baltimore, and I managed a health insurance plan that had about 20,000 subscribers. And I was always fascinated with the lack of care devoted to teeth, or like that. I just like was fascinated by it. And then I saw that your book came out, and I was like, I want to understand. So I'm happy that we're here.
It's great to be here.
So let's start with the sort of the big picture is, what are the things about dental care that you think are completely absent from the public conversation? What are those things?
As you pointed out just now, it's a separate piece of our healthcare system, and it's a piece that gets left off the table often because of its separation. And that separation dates back to your home city of Baltimore in 1840, with the founding of the first dental college in the world. It was opened right in Baltimore. And as the creation story of the dental profession goes, these early dentists who were self-trained gentlemen learned their skills from a more older provider, you know, just through the preceptorship system that dates back to the Middle Ages. They approached the physicians at the University of Maryland College of Medicine and asked if they would consider adding a course of dental training to the medical school. And this was 1840, time when, you know, specialization was just starting, scientific knowledge about medicine was just kind of evolving. The physician said that the subject of dentistry was of no consequence and sort of sent these dentists on their way. And these two gentlemen, Horace Hayden and Chapin Harris, started their dental college a few blocks away from the medical school in this whole separate profession that was not a specialty of medicine grew and evolved, and a separate payment system evolved, and a separate system of providing the care. And it's gone on like that for all these years, since generations. You know, we get our care in a separate place from our medical care. Typically, our medical records and our dental records are not kept together. They're not even really compatible code-wise. The payment system is separate. And you have to bridge this gap to get care, especially if you're a person who doesn't have benefits, which, you know, represents about, well, roughly a third of Americans. Either they've experienced significant barriers getting care due to the lack of money or benefits, or they're living in a geographical area without enough dentists or other oral health providers. There are millions and, you know, tens of millions of us, like roughly, you know, a third of our country is missing out on just routine care due to different barriers. They can't bridge this gap between the medical healthcare system and our dental system.
Ife?
Yeah, I think also it's the triple A's for me. There's lack of awareness, there's lack of access, and a lack of affordability. We have entire communities where they are the dental deserts, in essence. We don't have really education about oral health and how it impacts other systems in your body. It's not just that you have a toothache. It's how does that impact your cardiovascular disease or your diabetes or hypertension? All those things are interrelated, and we have separated your mouth like it belongs in another part of the room rather than in your body. We also, I think, sometimes forget to ask basic questions like, why do you brush? Are you brushing so that you have a happy smile? Are you doing it to get rid of the bacteria that could be deadly? Are you trying to make it so that you can get a job, you know, a fresh breath? We don't really even talk about why we brush or floss or any of those things. We have entire communities where they may have one dentist or no dentist at all to provide service to thousands of people, especially in rural communities. We look at this sometimes as being a heavy urban issue, but we have overlooked the fact that rural communities are probably as deeply impacted, if not more impacted, than some of the rural areas. And we don't look at the economic impact of dentistry. We don't talk about how it impacts the bottom line for businesses. We don't talk about how it affects education for children. We don't look at whether or not there's even a political will to address the issue. I mean, there's so many things on the plate. We could go on all day just with what the issues are. But we now just have to figure out how do we, as a collective, start addressing this and make it raise the public awareness and public perception about the importance of oral health to being something beyond just tooth decay.
What's the difference between dental care for kids and dental care for adults?
Well, under Medicaid, children are entitled to dental care under Medicaid. The adult dental benefits under Medicaid are considered optional, and states can add them or take them away. Just a few weeks ago, Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin's eliminated dental benefits and vision benefits for like 460,000 adults after a move to protest a court ruling related to the state decision to expand Medicaid under a previous governor. So these dental benefits can just disappear for adults in a day. So working poor adults who are struggling to make ends meet every day may not get dental benefits, and they face the same challenges that their children do in finding dental providers. Most dental care in this country is provided under the private practice system, and dentists tend to gravitate to the more, you know, affluent urban areas where they can, you know, they're assured a better return on their investment in their expensive educations and their equipment and staffing for their offices. And many of these communities, whether, as Ife mentioned, the rural communities, you know, people may have to travel several hours to find a dentist who will accept their benefits, or they may run up against the same issues that Mrs. Driver did, Diamante's mom. You know, the few Medicaid dentists were overbooked and not accepting new patients, or they were just not available to her children.
I've heard that, like, the dental lobby isn't necessarily pro-fixing the system in the way that people think it should be fixed, but I actually have no clue what that means, so I thought I'd ask.
Well, you've got pros and cons with that. You have people on both sides. You have a bunch of dentists who have a hard time, for example, with Medicaid because of the reimbursement rate is so extremely low that if dentists who want to serve Medicaid patients actually serve the number that they want to serve, they would end up paying to serve them. So that creates a problem.
Yeah, the dental lobby represents the interests of private practitioners, but there's a tension between those interests and public health interests, which focus on the health needs of an entire population. So that has been a recurring theme throughout the years, you know, through government and advocacy efforts to expand care to the tens of millions of Americans who've lacked it, and the private practitioners who've, you know, struggled for, you know, to maintain professional authority and autonomy.
What does expand care mean? Like, what would, if you could just expand care to people with dental, what would that mean?
Well, there are different public health measures, like fighting any other kind of disease that you can enact, like water fluoridation, for instance. It's a huge, you know, measure, a triumph of public health in the 20th century.
But that already exists.
But it reaches only 75% of people, and most of these decisions are made on a community level.
So all water's not fluoride? There's
no,
no fluoride in it?
No, not even no,
Greece.
No.
No.
Water supplies are controlled by, you know, usually municipal, you know, authorities or counties or county governments, and there's still a lot of misinformation about it. But that's one big step.
So part of expansion would be like fluoridation?
Yeah, community water fluoridation programs.
Okay,
yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah, that's a
okay,
big
what else?
Step. And, you know, and the organized dentistry has supported community water fluoridation. But there are places where organized dentistry and public health efforts have clashed. And a lot of those have to do with workforce issues, giving dental hygienists more autonomy to go out to public schools or public health clinics and screen children without first being examined by a dentist. There's a new workforce model. It's not new in other parts of the world, but here, dental therapists who are actually technically trained providers who are working in tribal areas in Alaska and Oregon and Washington State and Minnesota. Well, they work throughout the state of Minnesota, and they can actually drill and fill teeth. They work as part of dentist-headed teams, you know, to get more care to Medicaid patients.
What's the difference between a dental therapist, a dental hygienist, and a dentist?
Well, a dentist has gone through, you know, several years of training, is well-versed in a wide variety of procedures, and is considered the sort of head of the dental team. A dental hygienist is trained in prevention and patient education, and also does procedures that under the supervision of a dentist generally, but it could be a general supervision where he or she goes out to public health settings, screens, does sealants, does fluoride varnishes, different kinds of preventive care.
And they're the folks who do your cleanings.
Yeah, yeah. And then dental therapists who've been used for, you know, decades in other parts of the world do additional treatments that are considered by dentists irreversible surgical procedures, like drilling extractions. And the dental therapists who are working in this country, including in the tribal areas and in the state of Minnesota, they've also been approved to work in Maine, Vermont, and very recently in Arizona, but they haven't started yet.
Are there enough dentists?
No.
Why not?
Well, for one, it costs $1 million to become a dentist. A lot of folks
wow.
Come out of dental school and with terrible debt. And so you don't get a lot of the dentists that want to then go into some of the rural areas where they'll only get a few patients, or where they can't charge as much, and they've got to service that debt. So a lot of what you're seeing with the dentists are folks who are trying to stay afloat. Dentists sometimes get a bad rap for not doing more or being more giving or caring and all that kind of stuff, but they also have to feed their families and eat. And they come out really burdened out of dental school. We also just don't have enough people who are interested in the lack of sexiness that dentistry has, as opposed right. to becoming maybe a cardiologist or something like that. There's this hierarchy in medicine that for some reason people will say one area is better than the other. And so when you have people going to dental school, or you start talking to people about becoming a dentist, they don't want to put in all that time and effort and money to get a poor return.
Now, when we think about kids, I believe, because they're baby teeth, it's that what are the things that we aren't doing around dental prevention, dental hygiene? Like, I think about being in a school system in Baltimore, it's like I was always trying to figure out, like, what could we do to make sure all of our kids got, you know, I manage the employer part of the benefits, so my biggest reach was with our employees and then their kids. Like, if you had a magic wand, what would we be doing in every elementary school in the country with regard to dental care?
I would start with pregnancy. The pregnant mother needs dental care. And then we need to be educating that mother that their child should have their first visit by age one. And we don't ever think about children going to the dentist by age one. We need to start doing sealants and fluoride treatments and varnishes with children in daycare and elementary school. We need to have some sort of school-based clinics in all the schools or close by. We need to start making it possible for dental hygienists or therapists to go into schools and teach children about oral health and provide some of the things that poorer families may take as a luxury, like changing your toothbrush often enough. You know, people sometimes are using the same toothbrush 2 years later. So
how often are you supposed to change your toothbrush?
Probably about every 3 months.
And what is, you talked about sealant. What is sealant?
Well, it's kind of like a little, how would you say, a varnish. It's something that you place on the tooth to prevent decay.
So on the molars.
So that the teeth where the children are doing all the chewing and getting all the gummy stuff and the sweetness on their teeth that end up rotting those teeth, sometimes instead of trying to make sure that they're brushing after every meal and after every snack and after everything, all the sugary drinks, you seal the tooth and it keeps it from decaying.
Do a lot of people do that?
Oh, yes. Just not enough.
And the kids who need, you know, at highest risk often don't get the sealants. And there's school sealant programs in some states, but not others.
What are some of the misconceptions around dental care that you've experienced out in the field?
I think my very favorite of all times, we had a free clinic, and we did some surveys, and we asked people about how often they floss. And some people said they didn't, and we asked why they didn't. And my favorite answer was, because my teeth have been flossed already.
It's like a once in a lifetime thing.
It's been done. You know, why do it again?
Done that.
Yeah. So, you know, we have a lot of misconceptions about oral health. We don't know how much toothpaste even to use. We don't know how often you should brush. We don't know how long you should brush. We don't know the importance of flossing and why. We don't understand where cavities actually form. We don't understand the role of bacteria in our mouth. We don't understand the importance of oral health to job security.
What's the importance of oral health to job security? That's new to me.
Well, if you have a front desk job, and right now everyone is really into the concept of customer service and presenting this face to the community. If you have a tooth missing, and you could be the greatest receptionist in the world, but, you know, someone's not going to hire your smile if it's not a good smile. So you have people who, because they're poor or because they don't have good oral health or good care, end up having problems with their teeth, and it affects then their ability to get a job, which then makes their teeth worse, which then affects their ability to eat. All those things also affect their nutrition. It affects other organs in their body. There's a huge correlation, for example, between oral health and diabetes and obesity, which are things that run rampant in our community. All these things, you have a tendency for people to miss more jobs off of work because of oral health. More kids actually miss days out of school for oral health than any other reason. There are just a lot of misconceptions about the importance of oral health.
What about you, Mary?
The American Dental Association had a survey done a couple years ago, and it found that more than one-third of low-income American adults are reluctant to smile. And you think about that. You know, they're ashamed of their oral health and of their smiles and how that impacts their lives, you know, and their opportunities for social advancement or economic advancement, to get those jobs that can help them get out of poverty. And poor parents have a harder time, you know, helping their children maintain their oral health. They're worried and afraid. Sometimes they haven't been to the dentist for, you know, a long time, and they convey that kind of fear and reluctance and fatalism. You know, we've always lost our teeth in my family, that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's a message that gets passed on through the generations. When you've been sort of shut out of access, it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy on so many levels.
I'll tell you one of the other things that always got me. When we would do health screenings out in the community, we might be in a mall, and people would come in and they would be willing to get pap smears, mammograms, all kinds of things, where they had to basically kind of expose themselves a bit. But if you asked them to open their mouth to do a dental exam, we had to make sure that was probably more screened than the pap smear area, because people are so embarrassed about opening their mouths. And we don't really think about how self-conscious people are about their oral health.
One of the things that was spoken about earlier was that for doctors or dentists, I mean, who use Medicaid for dentistry, that some of them are essentially losing money, or they're paying money to participate in the program. Did I hear that right?
Just about. That's the reason why a lot of folks don't take it.
What's the fix? Is it that we need to up the reimbursement amount for dental things, or is it too high so we need to lower the cost of the services? Like, what's the policy fix on that front?
I think we really need to raise the reimbursement rate for dentists on this. I think everyone's in agreement that the reimbursement rate for Medicaid is much, much too low. That, you know, it really is at a point where it doesn't really cover the cost of the service. And for a lot of folks on Medicaid who have extensive services that need to be done, you're not going to be able to get like a root canal unless you're going to pay out of pocket. And who has, you know, a few thousand dollars to put into their mouth if they're on Medicaid?
What are the advocacy organizations that people should look to who are fighting for dental equity?
Well, Oral Health 2020 is one that I'm working with, and they've been on the forefront of doing social justice issues with oral health and trying to raise public perception and awareness and do education for expanded adult benefits and pregnant mothers and children. And that's a network that's growing in leaps and bounds. The ADA, which sometimes is at odds with some of the other groups also, though, is really working hard at trying to get a better educated populace and getting information out to their constituents. I forget the name of the dental hygienist group.
American Dental Hygienist Association.
Yes, and they are the educators. They're going out and doing quite a bit. But in your local communities, you'll find a number of groups, especially the FQHCs, the Federally Qualified Health Centers, that are available in your area that are fighting for their lives right now because a lot of them, I think 50-something percent, don't even get federal funding. They're fighting for their lives to fight for your life. So if you have a federally qualified health system in your area, you should be working to try and help them stay afloat.
So if I have one in my neighborhood, but I'm not using it, what does it mean to, like, help it stay afloat?
Well, one of the things they do is they also provide service to people with insurance. Having people who are insured going in helps them pay their bills. But also doing a lot more of that GOTV effort, getting out the vote, talking with your legislators, making sure you're going to town hall meetings and coffee hours with your legislators to tell them about the importance of oral health and why you need it and why you want them to fund it and why you need them to support it in your local state legislation as well as your at the federal level. We need to have more people being vocal about health as we are about all the other issues, and we have so many of them right now that we're facing in the country.
Yeah, healthcare will be a major issue in the midterm elections. And, you know, the future of funding for Medicaid and Medicare will be, a huge topic as people decide who to vote for.
Well, we consider you both friends of the pod. Thanks so much for joining, and can't wait to get an update later.
Thanks, Doreen.
Thank you.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. Tell your friends to check it out. Make sure to rate it wherever you get your podcast, whether it's Apple Podcasts or somewhere else. And we'll see you next week.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action, not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.